Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The other night in Brooklyn, New Yorker staff writer Jennifer Gonerman met up with Sergeant Edwin Raymond of the NYPD.
It's quite a scene out here.
Yeah. Lincoln Terrace is pretty popular. You got basketball. Looks like somewhat of a tournament.
You got cricket here, huh?
Yeah, from Jamaica, Trinidad, Guyana, Barbados, etc. Most of the British West Indies, they play cricket.
When they met, it was past 9 at night, and Raymond had been held up for a few hours, which is certainly not uncommon if you work as a police officer.
Yeah, there was an incident with missing children, so that kind of extended the day a little bit.
Which train is that overhead?
That's the 3 train going towards New Locks.
And you used to work in the trains, right?
Correct. After the police academy, I was assigned to the Transit Bureau, and I patrolled the rails for 7 years.
Jen wanted to talk to Sergeant Raymond because he's something of a controversial figure in New York policing, a whistleblower. Raymond joined the force 10 years ago, but in 2015, he and 11 others filed a class action suit against the police department and its commissioner at the time, William Bratton. The officers became known as the NYPD 12, and the crux of their lawsuit was that the department was using monthly quotas on things like arrests and summons that officers had to meet. And the people who bore the brunt of those quotas, they said, were most often African-American and Latino residents in poor neighborhoods, places like Brownsville in eastern Brooklyn, where Sergeant Raymond currently works.
It's a challenging area. The statistics in terms of stop and frisk and quota policing, these are the areas where this stuff is applied the most. I actually purposely chose it because I felt that as someone who criticizes bad police policy, I can't go where it's easy. If I don't actually go there to see for myself, then it's just lip service.
And at what point did you start to think there might be something amiss or questionable about some of the practices you were seeing?
Even before I joined, because of what I experienced. The racial profiling, the horrible lack of professionalism from cops. I experienced those things, so I already knew something was wrong.
Was there one moment in particular when you were a teenager growing up that stands in your memory?
Yeah, absolutely. I was 18 years old. I was walking with my girlfriend at the time, and plainclothes officers jumped out and just threw me to the wall and just started illegally searching me. And they basically emptied my pockets and left everything on the floor. I was so embarrassed. And on the opposite corner, there were people watching me get searched. And in that crowd were some folks that were actually criminals. And they were watching me get searched. And I realized at that moment that to those officers, there was no difference between them and me. And the only thing I had in common with them was ancestry and, race, ethnicity. That's it. There was nothing else. At the time I was getting ready to go to college. I never smoked. I think I used to, make a little underage drinking at the time.
And then when you actually got into the academy and joined the police force, was there one moment in particular when you just thought, what is going on here? Or
so after the academy, the very first day on patrol is when I noticed that the lieutenant was fixated on just arrest summonses and stop and frisk. And, we're working in the transit system. It's a few years after 9/11. I'm assuming obviously there will be times where we have to arrest summons and possibly stop and frisk. So it's important to learn those things. But I learned that first day that that's all that mattered.
I think that's a police helicopter?
It absolutely is. Once it's hovering like that, that's aviation being called for a job.
What do you think that means?
I don't see the searchlight, so they're using probably just a fleeing someone. Could have been a shooting, and they're looking for someone on the rooftop. They're circling. Yeah, they're doing a search.
Let's break it down a little bit. Summonses. What are summonses?
Summonses are basically tickets in lieu of an arrest. So things that are violations, where instead of overwhelming the court system, the city decides to make money by issuing a summons instead. Things like public consumption of alcohol, public urination, smoking in areas that you're not supposed to smoke, being in the park after dark. You know, innocuous things that are unlawful, but, you know, there's no need to overwhelm the court system for.
Could we get a summons? We're in the park after dark.
The sign has to be there that says park closes at dusk. So if there's no sign, you're fine.
Okay, all right. What year did they officially ban quotas in New York?
So quotas were already unlawful, but there was a new bill that tightened up the loopholes that the department was able to use, and that bill became law in August of 2010.
And so when you're working in transit, and you said you were feeling pressure to get arrests, summonses, stop and frisks, what form did the pressure take? Would they say it explicitly? What would they say to you?
Well, yeah, back in 2009, there was no ambiguity. It was straight up, you know, this is what we want. They'll give exact numbers of what they want of each category, and that's all that mattered. And if you didn't meet the quota, you started getting retaliatory posts.
What would be a retaliatory post?
This train station that's barely frequented, 20 degrees outside, and you're in an elevated outdoor train station just freezing by yourself. That's one thing. Or the police jargon, sitting on a prisoner in the hospital, meaning guarding a hospitalized prisoner.
And what was the quota that you were given back then? What were the types of numbers you were expected to hit?
They wanted 2 and 10 at times. Sometimes it'd be 4 and 20, 1 and 5. But in impact as a rookie, it's usually no less than 2 arrests, 10 summonses, and 10 stop and frisk.
Per month.
What you would get is officers that try to, you know, I put that in quotes, get it out the way early. So they'll hit the ground running the first week. And you had officers who kind of waited for it to happen organically. And if it didn't, that last few days, they started what we refer to as ice picking, which is just petty, the most innocuous things that they'll criminalize just to meet their numbers.
What would be an example of ice picking?
It's stranger than fiction. Someone biting into a jelly donut, and the hole that you insert the jelly into the donut, jelly oozing out of that hole and falling onto the platform, and the person being arrested for littering. Somebody peeling the paint off of the column in the train station, arrested for defacing transit property. It all goes back to systemic racism. The fact that what they're enforcing, they can't enforce in Park Slope. You know, white, you know, predominantly white areas, Garrettson Beach, you know, Upper West Side. But yet here they are in Flatbush, in Crown Heights, in Harlem, Mott Haven, Southside Jamaica, enforcing these things.
And when this message is being sent down the ranks, what kind of words do they use? What kind of euphemisms do they use to try to encourage?
You have to address your conditions. You have to pay the rent.
What does that mean, pay the rent?
Meet the quota. You know, make sure you pay the rent.
Now, I know if I called the NYPD today and asked them, do you have quotas? They would say, absolutely not. We have no quotas. But is it your sense that quotas still exist in the department?
Quotas absolutely still exist. Thankfully, where I work now, there are no quotas. But since I've taken such a public stance, when I'm off duty, sometimes even on duty, officers from other precincts will approach me and say, thank you for what you're doing, and share stories of what's happening today in their respective commands. Quotas are still a very real way of how the department operates. Like, those numbers are still what's incentivized. People respond to incentives. That officer that wants to make detective or go to a specialized unit doesn't have to be a genius to realize what's going to be respected and allow him or her to make it into that unit, to make it to detective.
And I remember it was 2016, right? Opening up the Sunday Times, seeing the cover of the magazine, and there was your face talking about that lawsuit. You were on the cover, and I thought, how long is this guy really going to last in the department? I mean, I don't, you know, it was such a brave thing to do. I just imagined it might be career suicide.
Yeah.
And what kind of response did you get from your fellow officers after the piece came out? Were you afraid you were going to lose your job?
I was ready to lose my job. I anticipated anything that can happen, even losing my life. And I hate to have to say losing my life, but let's be honest. You know, we saw what happened to Frank Serpico. There's no reason why something like that can't happen to me or the others. So.
But here you are.
Yeah.
Still in the department.
The article pretty much changed my life. New York Times has a lot of reach, and journalists from all around the world reached out to me. And that's when I really, truly saw just how wide Bratton's cancer had spread. As far as the Metropolitan Police in London, Gothenburg, Sweden, it was unbelievable. And I started doing more research into Bratton.
Tell us about Comstat. What role does that play in all of this?
Comstat is something that Commissioner Bratton incorporated with the broken window style of policing that he became a big fan of in the early 80s. And basically, when certain major incidents occur, like murders, rapes, grand larcenies, robberies, burglaries, you know, and shootings, when those things occur, the commanding officer is held accountable for addressing those conditions, and that's done in a Comstat meeting. And you see, if you were to stop the tape there, it seems like something noble, something good, something that makes sense. But where it becomes problematic is what's accepted as a response. In transit, for instance, say we're getting a condition, meaning something serious, like a robbery, a grand larceny, something very common in transit. People tend to look into their phones, and unfortunately, people who are up to no good snatch the phones and escape as the doors are closing. So say New Lots on the 3 line, we're getting a lot of phone snatches at 1 a.m. As long as you increase arrest at New Lots, be it 3 p.m., 4 p.m., school kids who double up through the turnstile together or probably don't have their metric cards. Just keep arresting a whole bunch of school kids at 4 p.m. and you won't have to answer for the 1 a.m. robbery.
So just showing an uptick in numbers of summonses or arrests in the same location
within
is going to satisfy your bosses? Is that?
Pretty much, yeah.
When folks were calling you from other countries, were they reporters or activists? And what did they want to know? Why were they reaching out to you?
Honestly, in the early 90s, crime starts dropping. And as Mayor Dinkins' tenure ends and Giuliani's administration starts with Commissioner Bratton, who then implements the broken windows policing, again, crime that was already plummeting continues to plummet. So broken windows pretty much gets the credit for that. This brings a lot of publicity to New York and Bratton. And so what happens is different police departments throughout the nation and world, they send representatives to learn Bratton's strategies in Comstat and quality of life, broken windows policing. And they bring back this type of policing to their respective cities. So when I say Bratton's cancer, that's what I'm referring to, the spread of broken windows, quality of life, quota policing. It really starts to spread throughout different parts of the nation and different parts of the world. And when it was reporters from other countries that were reaching out because they had issues in policing in their cities, some of them, they start getting issues with quotas. And they said, wow, okay, maybe this is responsible for what we're experiencing because, you know, we're experiencing similar things.
You know, one of the amazing things here about your story is how you somehow managed to flip the script on whistleblowing. And here we are, 2 years later, you're still on the police force, you've been promoted to sergeant. It's like the whistleblower who managed to hold on to his job, it almost never happens.
Yeah, that is quite unprecedented, which is why it gives hope to a lot of officers throughout the nation. Many officers reach out on social media platforms just saying, please keep pushing on, you know, we're having issues here. Although, you know, there's a lot of animosity, hatred, and things to be cautious about, but the support has been overwhelming at the same time.
What form does that animosity take, that hatred take?
at details, meaning like parades or large events where you'd have officers from different parts of the city working together. Officers who recognize me but are not used to seeing me, you'll see just the body language. You'll see them pointing, some of them whispering, that's the rat. You know, that's the rat. Although I'm speaking about systemic issues, although I'm speaking about the upper echelon who are in a position to change this, cops of all ranks feel personally attacked. So that shocked me, because if you really pay attention, this is actually beneficial for officers, because you don't have to be, you know, that petty officer that's going to go bother someone that just wants to take a quick shortcut through the park to get home from a late shift. You know, at first I thought officers would kind of embrace this more. I don't know. It's something I'm still learning, because if you pay attention, you should be rooting for me. You should be rooting for the NYPD 12, you know?
That was Edwin Raymond of the New York City Police Department talking with Jennifer Gonerman, a staff writer for The New Yorker. The lawsuit by Sergeant Raymond and the NYPD 12 is the subject of a new documentary that's out on Hulu, and it's called Crime and Punishment. And that's it for the show today. We hope you'll join us next week. And in the meantime, make sure to follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Kalalia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. This week, we're saying a special thanks and a fond farewell to our colleague Mithali Rao. Good luck across the pond. They're lucky to have you. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.